clockwork cores inside them. The purpose of the clockwork cores was to rapidly expand the builder's forces, producing constructs and converted at a greater pace than any equivalent power could be assembled. As invaders, the ability to rapidly expand their initial forces was of incredible value. The sources of the cores were clockwork kings, which Jason had only seen one of. It had been an ancient and crippled one, dug up on Earth by the engineers of Ascension. They had used the damaged cores it could still produce as part of their human augmentation project. Before his death, the EOA leader, Norrith, had given Jason access to a vault filled with EOA secrets and resources. The Clockwork King counted as both, and Jason had destroyed it himself, making sure no one would be able to use it again. Clockwork Kings were gold rank, and Jason didn't sense any auras on that level. The kings weren't built for stealth, and even if they were, it was incredibly difficult for the builder's power to escape Jason's attention. As such, any clockwork king in the vicinity would have to be on the other side of the aperture, inside the astral space. Jason turned his attention to the forces he was certain of. Leading the small army of constructs and abominations was a cadre of essence users. Jason could sense the star seeds worming through their bodies and souls. There were 5 silver rankers and 12 bronze. "Mr. Asano," Shade said, next to Jason in the undergrowth. "While I fear the answer is obvious, I am obligated to ask if this is truly the approach you wish to take. I know you wish to assess the effectiveness of your ability to influence objects related to the Builder. My concern is that, in another state of mind perhaps, you might come to regret using people, even these people, as subjects of weapon experimentation." Jason turned his head to look at the shadow creature beside him, then back out at the enemy. At this point, what's one more regret? Clockwork cores and starseeds were the 2 kinds of artifacts the Builder used to invest power into its minions. Clockwork cores were the lesser, as they were produced by other minions rather than the Builder itself and not direct conduits to the Builder. Because they were not, it was even possible to use them outside of the Builder's influence. Jason had already tested his power against the damaged, modified variants that the EOA salvaged. The effects there had been extreme and lethal. Now, he was going to test his influence over the undamaged, unmodified variant. He didn't bother to hide, stepping out of the jungle and shrouded in his starlight cloak. His aura washed out like a flood over the Builder's minions, and Jason used it to reach into the constructs and abominations. Jason had hoped his influence over the clockwork cores would allow him to shut them down entirely. He found that he could do far more than that, at least with the weaker bronze rank enemies. He had experience erasing the Builder's imprint from the dimensional door and absorbing it for his own, plus the power the door gave him in influencing other Builder artifacts with his aura. This allowed him to seize control of the bronze rank constructs entirely, erasing their Builder's imprint and making them his own. As for the silver rank constructs, he lacked the strength to take them over. The best he could do was impede their coordination and speed while directing the bronze rank ones to attack them. The results with the cyborg-like converted were different and much more horrific. Seizing control of the artificial parts of their bodies through the cores inside them left the flesh fighting the steel. The abominations started ripping themselves apart, the artificial parts yanking themselves off the flesh to which they were macabrely welded. Whirling saw blade limbs and flame-spitting orifices turned on the very bodies they were attached to. Like their construct equivalents, the silver rank abominations were more resistant to control than the bronze rankers. The fleshy part of them resisted Jason's efforts, but that flesh also made them vulnerable. The freakish bodies of the abominations were kept alive by the magic of their artificial parts. Rather than try and take full control, Jason focused on shutting off the magic in the artificial parts that kept the living parts alive. The converted were soon gasping for air and bleeding. The blood seeped from their eyes, as well as from the points where steel was grafted into flesh. Within moments of his appearance, and without so much as raising a hand, Jason had turned the construct army into a gruesome and chaotic spectacle of death. He walked slowly across the torched clearing, stepping over smouldering logs and around still-burning brush that threw smoke up and out over the jungle. The essence users escaped the sudden and gruesome chaos, fighting their way free of the army that, moments ago, had been under their control. Their attention locked on Jason, whose aura was unhidden and obviously the source of the madness. As the essence users moved towards him, the five silver anchors tried exerting suppressive force with their own auras to negate Jason's influence on their army. The attempt was a miserable failure. Their auras shrank back from Jason's as if stung. The auras of the essence users were thick with the Builder's energy, shaped by the star seeds in their souls. Jason knew that power, which was scored onto his soul in the Builder's attempts to torture Jason into accepting a starseed. As a result, there was no power that Jason knew better how to fight back against. Jason poured his rage onto the essence users, smashing their auras to nothing. He didn't stop there, attacking their very souls the way their master had once attacked him. In doing so, the Builder had invested in Jason the exact same ability, effectively handing a powerful weapon to his enemy. Their souls were as inviolable to Jason as his own had been to the Builder. Unless they opened themselves up to him, which they never would, he could only do what their master did to him and scour their souls, inflicting a pain that transcended the physical. Pain, as it turned out, was enough. The bodies of the bronze rankers were unable to handle it, collapsing to the ground. The silver rankers were stronger, but not strong enough, stopping dead in their tracks. That was when the Builder stepped in personally. Starseeds had two elements, the physical element in the body and the spiritual element in the soul. Jason felt the Builder's power flood through the spiritual element and into the physical element, allowing it to take control of the essence user's bodies, bolstering them with power. Jason had once fought such a vessel and knew how strong they were, but to become one was a death sentence. Any unprepared vessel could only embody a greater astral being for minutes before burning out. The vessels Jason had seen in the past, like Thadwick, had gone through weeks of preparation and even they lasted only so long. The vessels embodied the Builder's power but also its limitations, meaning they were no longer allowed to take action. Even before Dawn had gained concessions from Shaco, the Builder had conceded to the World Phoenix and the Reaper that it would no longer use vessels on Palimustis. By embodying the essence users through their starseeds, he had rendered them unable to act. Like Dawn representing the World Phoenix, Builder vessels could do no more than talk. The bronze rankers got to their feet, and the silver rankers moved forward, forming a line in front of Jason. Their synchronized voices were cold and mechanical as they spoke in a perfect chorus.
Asano.
Chapter 49. A Fair Fight. Jason looked at the vessels of the Builder arrayed in front of him. Yet again, the Builder was pushing the boundaries of his agreement with the other great astral beings, reinforcing their unreliability. It reminded him all over again that none of them cared about the welfare of one mortal. Their only concern was how he could impact their agenda, or perhaps their pride as higher beings that look down on mortals. Once again, Jason found himself in front of a vastly more powerful entity, and he was tired. Tired of ranting, tired of anger, tired of challenging powers he had no business standing in front of. He wondered what the Builder even wanted from him this time. What did he get out of talking? Jason looked towards the shallow cave with the aperture inside. What the Builder got from talking to Jason was Jason talking back. While Jason made another speech full of threats he couldn't possibly carry out, the Builder would have time to direct his forces within the astral space and converge on the aperture, waiting for Jason's arrival. Jason didn't say anything to the Builder's vessels. Instead, he sank into his own shadow and reappeared in the dark mouth of the cave. The aperture was a glowing, circular portal, flickering like a television with bad reception.
"Keep an eye on it,"
Jason said, as a shade body left Jason's shadow and Jason stepped into the portal. Astral spaces were too stable for him to enter from anywhere, the way he could with a protospace, but his power did allow him to ignore the seals on apertures. It was the very reason he had claimed the power, to enter a sealed astral space in search of Farah. The Builder's vessels turned in unison when Jason vanished from in front of them and reappeared in the cave, moving directly into the aperture. A shadowy figure moved out of the cave, slipping from shadow to shadow through the still-fighting constructs and semi-construct flesh abominations. It exited the melee unaccosted and approached the Builder's vessels. They were already showing signs of breaking down, their skin turning stony and starting to flake.
Reaper spawn,
the vessels chorused in perfect unity with cold, mechanical voices.
Great being,
Shade greeted respectfully.
I have spent some time on Mr. Asano's homeworld, as you know. They do not have any gods that I am aware of, yet it is a world rife with stories of them. The gods in most of these mythologies are very mortal in their failings. They have story after story of petty, vain, and cruel deities using humans as proxies in their conflicts, always to the suffering of the mortals. I had thought this a reflection of their own inadequacies, a collective social assertion of higher beings just as flawed as they, thus excusing their own shortcomings. Now I find myself wondering if I was incorrect. Many of these myths stem from a period in which one of your clockwork kings was entombed. I do not know what it was doing there, but perhaps your involvement in that world inspired the pettiness, cruelty, and vanity of their mythological deities.
You are impudent, Spawn.
And you are 13 billion years old, yet somehow the same 16-year-old boy who was raised to the position you now hold. I do not know how you were chosen, but the great astral beings have made enough other mistakes that I know their decisions are not infallible.
You are limited, Spawn. Measuring me by the time reference of this petty world only makes it plain.
Yes, that is what limits me, Shade said, the arbitrary value by which I chose to account for time. I shall take it as a lesson learned and consider myself appropriately admonished.
Jenny Cavaloa moved swiftly, rushing towards the aperture with the rest of the expedition. They had spotted the smoke in the distance and left the road, heading through the jungle towards it. Jenny had given up on any kind of delicate process, sending out a wild storm of ice blades to open a path. The fast-moving and razor-sharp cloud annihilated every obstacle in the group's path as they dashed behind it on their various means of transport. Trees were smashed to splinters and undergrowth was sliced to confetti. The ice blades even went through a rock the size of a house, the group riding through a dust cloud as pebbles rained down on them. Jenny was not straining her senses. The aura projection required to do so could alert monsters at even greater range than the noise her demolition cloud was making. Even so, her gold rank perception picked up what was happening in the clearing well before they reached it, although none of it made any sense. She had fought the Builder's forces before and recognized the auras of their construct creatures and macabre converted. What she had not seen before was them fighting each other. That barely entered her attention, however, compared to the other auras on the scene. Most were bronze rank with a handful of silvers, but there was something inside all of them that was more dangerous than their rank. It was a power like that of a manifested god, but also different and alien. She could only assume this was the presence of the Builder himself. She had heard of him taking vessels, but none had been seen since the early days of the cultist conflict. Whatever the power was, she could sense it rapidly eating the people containing it from the inside out. She could not sense Jason Asano anywhere. Jason was moving before he even had time to sense his surroundings when he emerged from the portal. Even so, he was riddled with attacks. His cloak intercepted the weaker ones, but a flaming projectile seared through his robes to scorch his torso, and a spear pierced through his gut and out the other side. The astral space was some kind of sweltering subterranean landscape, and Jason easily disappeared into the shadows, even with a spear still lodged in him. He didn't bother to look back, moving quickly but silently through what turned out to be an ant's nest of volcanic tunnels, complete with lava-spitting ants. Jason lost his pursuers in a vast cavern containing a lake of magma. He was grateful that he didn't need to breathe the scorching air because he wasn't sure he could have. He could move stealthily past the many ants. Since they went after any builder minions that encroached, he had time to stop and remove the spear impaling him. The corrosive lava spit of the ants was highly effective against the metal constructs, making them trouble for the minions. The only light came from the glowing magma lake, an orange-tinted gloom, like being inside a smoldering ember. Jason moved through undetected, his cloak dimmed to void black as he used it to fly over the lake. There was something inside the lake, submerged in lava. It was bigger than the ants by a considerable margin, although by exactly how much was hard to tell. It was at least the size of two school buses side by side. He suspected it to be the queen of the ants, presuming they had one. Its aura marked it as silver rank, although definitely in the upper range. Jason hovered as close as he could to the cavern ceiling so as to not tempt fate. Jason didn't extend his senses far, but could feel the unhidden auras of the builder minions as they rushed in the direction of the aperture. After coming through the aperture to the expected ambush, Jason had been forced to dash off and take stock. The cultists waiting had not chased him for long once he disappeared into the magma cavern. Instead, they gravitated to where they knew he would be eventually. At some point, he would have to go back to the aperture. Unfortunately for the builder's minions, Jason had inadvertent allies in the ants. Jason could easily hide from them as their aura senses were poor, and Shade could deceive their insect vibrational sense. There was also the issue of the entire astral space being a lava tunnel maze. Jason's map ability was a boon, helping navigate a path and track the enemies along it. As he made his way back towards the aperture, he took every chance to bait the ants in the direction of cultists with pinpoint bursts of aura. The cultists were right in thinking Jason would return to the aperture. His advantage was that he could scout it out instead of walking in blind, but time was against him. The builder had been sending his cultists in the direction of the aperture since Jason's arrival in the clearing. Fortunately, the constructs and semi-construct flesh abominations were more liability than asset. Jason's ability to hijack the clockwork cores made them worse than useless when fighting him, so they had been sent away. Jason spotted them deeper into the tunnels, engaging ants to clear a path for essence using cultists. More than once, he resisted the temptation to take some over. The cultists were connected to the builder through their star seeds, which linked them in a similar fashion to Jason's party interface. Once any of them found where he was, they all would, so every time he was spotted, they would get closer to boxing him in. Jason did not want to give up the strategic advantages of speed and stealth to drag a bunch of mind-controlled minions in his wake. He returned to the chamber containing the aperture within minutes of leaving it. Five silver rank essence users were waiting near the aperture. Jason had hoped for fewer, but expected more. Only silver rank essence users posed any kind of threat, at least amongst the forces at hand, so they had only left foes that could pose an actual threat. The cavern in which the aperture was located was not large compared to the magma lake chamber. Light came from natural orange crystals growing out of every surface of the natural cavern. Walls, floor, and ceiling, if the uneven chamber could truly be said to have the distinctions, all featured them. So did the stalagmites and stalactites. The uneven cave floor and pervasive shadows meant that anyone without enhanced agility, reflexes, and perception would quickly break a leg. The only place the floor had been worked flat was directly under the aperture, where a sealing ritual had been set up. That was what Jason needed to undo to give the rest of the expedition access. The terrain was ideal for Jason to skirmish through if it came to a fight, but with five silver rank enemies, he would prefer it didn't come to that. This was not Greenstone. 5-on-1 odds were something he'd rather avoid, even if the environment was favourable and he could overwhelm their auras. If just one or two of them were at a guild level, their numerical advantage could easily spell death. Following his defeat at the hands of the Purity Priests, Jason had made additional purchases while restocking his equipment. At the top of that list was a set of the most powerful cleansing potions his body could handle. He had learned his lesson about being too reliant on his resistances. Another purchase was something he made after considering the fights in his future. Most of Jason's battles had been against monsters, and he needed new strategies that prepared him to face essence users. This was especially true when he was outnumbered, which seemed to be most of the time. After considering his options and advantages, Jason had devised a tactic using one of his strongest tools and a set of items he had picked up quite a lot of over the years. He only had a few that were as strong as he needed, but a few was enough. Because the items were on the Adventure Society's controlled list, Jason's one-star rank did not allow him to buy more. Familiars were unable to join Jason's party chat, but Jason and Shade could still converse safely. Shade could hide Jason from various senses, including masking his sound, but that sound was not masked from Shade himself.
"Time to try the new strategy," Jason told his familiar. "Get into position."
5 Shade bodies slipped away, moving through the dark to hide in the shadows of the 5 essence users. Once they were in place, Jason's aura dropped on the cultists like a bomb. Without the builder actively boosting them, which would just make more pointless talking vessels, Jason's aura suppression was especially effective. In the same moment that Jason suppressed their auras, a Shade body rose from each of their shadows, pulling silver rank suppression collars from within Shade's storage space. Only with suppressed auras would the suppression collars be able to take effect, which was why they weren't often used in combat. Only with a rank or numerical disparity for powerful aura suppression was it a viable method for shutting down the powers of opponents. Unfortunately for the cultists, their master was the primary factor in Jason turning into a one-man force multiplier. Shade acted quickly. 4 collars snapped around 4 necks. Only one of the essence users reacted quickly enough to prevent the sneak attack, sending out a wave of force that knocked back Shade's body, even though it was intangible, along with a man's collared fellows. That left 1 cultist facing off against Jason. The others weren't helpless, but locked out of their powers, their impact would be limited. It was, ostensibly, a fair fight. Jenny was taken aback by what she sensed waiting in the clearing, but she didn't slow as she led the expedition group onward. They reached the clearing and surveyed what they found, which was bizarre on every front. The Builder's forces were fighting one another, constructs and flesh abominations, in a wildly destructive melee, where they attacked not just each other, but even themselves at times. The other scene in the clearing was very different in its stillness, yet no less strange. One of Asano's shadow familiars was facing a plumb straight line of Builder cultists, who were visibly dying as their bodies broke down, skin splitting and flesh crumbling to dust. Even so, the cultists didn't react to their own conditions, standing like troops at inspection. Every member of the expedition sensed the power inside the cultists and how dangerous it was. Every member of the expedition had seen gods appear in worship squares and religious ceremonies and knew the feel of divinity. This was similar, but like a mannequin that was both a little too human and not quite human enough, there was an uncanny alienness to that power that put them all on alert. The bodies of the lined essence users were drying out and crumbling away. Cracked and desiccated like the mud of a long dry riverbed, their flesh fell in dust and dry clumps, like eroded soil in a drought. The bronze rank cultists were nearing the end of their endurance even as the expedition arrived, one of them collapsing to the ground in front of them. None of the others showed any reaction, turning their attention to the newcomers with eerily uniform precision.
"Adventurers of Rimaros,"
the vessels addressed them in impassive harmony.
"I am the Builder, and I have a proposal for you."
Chapter 50. Put the Mask Back On. Inside the magma tunnels of the astral space, Jason was facing off with 5 cultists, 4 of whom had suppression collars, courtesy of Jason and Shade's surprise attack. The lack of powers rendered them effectively non-threats, but Jason wasn't taking chances. As he walked openly towards them, he held out a hand to his side, the palm growing slick as blood seeped from his skin. The blood on Jason's palm suddenly went from a gentle seep to a violent geyser, accumulating in the form of a blood clone that looked like a dark red copy of Jason, minus the cloak of darkness. "Colin, watch the packaged meat," Jason instructed. "If it starts going bad, eat it fast." The one cultist not locked into a collar showed no interest in looking out for his fellows. He did just the opposite, moving away from the other four as the familiar approached them with slow, methodical steps. The cultist never took his eyes from Jason as he sidestepped out of the apocalypse beast's path, remaining alert to attack. The collared cultists tried to run, only for blood-soaked leather straps to shoot out from Colin. They grabbed the disempowered cultists and dragged them back to the familiar's feet. Jason felt the surge of power from the starseeds within them as they tried to self-detonate, and he locked them down with his aura. This was not a trick that came from the magic of the Builder's Door that Jason had absorbed. It was something he had learned to do when a starseed had been implanted in his own body, through which the Builder tried to make Jason give up his soul. Since then, Jason learned to use the soul attack he'd experienced from the Builder's assault to lock down other starseeds. He hadn't understood how the ability truly worked when he first used it back in Greenstone, but he had changed a lot since then. Jason was no longer a dual entity of body and soul the way most physical beings were. For him, body and soul were the same thing, giving him significant insight into any effects that played into them. He also had the bridge stolen from the Builder, further enhancing his ability to understand how the Builder's power operated. The soul of any being was inviolable unless it opened itself to penetration. The Builder's failure to invade Jason's soul was a demonstration that Jason would have preferred to go without. Turning it around, if the effectively infinite power of the Builder couldn't overcome this limitation, then Jason couldn't either. This made a starseed inside someone's soul untouchable, however strong his ability to influence the Builder's artifacts might have been. Not all of a starseed was held within the soul, however. While each great astral being used its own kind of starseed, they were all, by necessity, a reflection of the basic patterns of physical beings. They were made up of both physical and spiritual components, which lodged themselves in the physical and spiritual aspects of living beings. For this reason, messengers and similar beings whose soul and physical state were a single aspect, which now included Jason, were immune to starseed implantation. Jason was unable to do a lot with the physical aspect of a starseed, as the protected spiritual component was the element that controlled it. The most he could do was lock down the physical component and prevent it from enacting commands sent from within the soul. Jason's understanding of the dual nature of most physical beings wasn't generally useful. The two aspects were like perfect halves of a sphere, seamlessly sealed together, with nowhere to take purchase. When Jason used his ability to attack a soul, all he was doing was scratching at the exterior or squeezing it like a ball. There was nothing to grab hold of and really go to work, but a starseed changed that considerably. Jason locked down the physical aspects of the cultist's starseed to stop their self-detonation. He hadn't done this in years, and in the intervening time he had gone through considerable changes. Now when he grabbed at the starseeds, he had a revelation. The physical aspect of a starseed was like a handle sticking out through a cultist's soul, a handle that he could grab. Looking at the uncollared cultist through a new lens, Jason didn't see a man. He saw a sphere with a great big handle poking out the side. Half of that sphere was untouchable. But what if he grabbed that handle and used it to wrench off that half that wasn't? He couldn't rip the man's soul out of his body, but maybe he could tear the body off the soul. The cultist and Jason were still in a standoff, staring one another down. Neither had moved since Colin tied up the other cultists, who were now bound up in wet, red leather straps like insects in a web. From the cultist's perspective, that was fine. It bought time for reinforcements to arrive. For Jason, it allowed him to concentrate on forging a new weapon in his soul arsenal. Jason projected his aura in twin talons that dug through the cultist's aura. One gripped the man's soul, while the other gripped the physical element of the starseed. Then, Jason started to twist. The man froze, eyes wide, as he felt something try to wrench apart the very foundation of his being. For Jason, it also felt like a physical struggle, as if he were trying to yank the man's soul from his body with brute strength. The difference in soul strength between the two silver rankers was like a bodybuilder fighting a child, and the cultist was helpless to resist. Jason was certain that unless the builder stepped in and turned the cultist into a vessel, he could not be stopped. Since doing so would go far beyond simply using some vessels to talk, Jason was confident the great astral being would not. Saving the cultist wasn't worth the price. The two men struggled while standing dead still, staring at one another. The other cultists lay where they were tied up, watching in fear and confusion. Despite having their aura sensors sealed, the collared cultists could sense the powerful aura reactions coming from within the cultist Jason was spiritually attacking. The sheer force of it washed over them, the inherent wrongness of it screaming at their souls.
"Mr. Asano, I recommend against this course of action."
Jason ignored Shade, his face warped with hate as he felt the strain he was placing on the bond between the cultist's body and soul. The man wasn't even resisting anymore. He swayed and started to twitch. Shade rose from Jason's shadow, standing at his side.
"Mr. Asano, I strongly recommend against this course of action."
Jason continued to twist and wrench, feeling the cultist's spiritual foundation beginning to tear.
"Jason, stop it!"
Shade never yelled. Shade never told when he could suggest. And Shade never used Jason's first name. Doing all three at once had finally broken through to him. The cultist dropped to the ground, frothing at the mouth as Jason released him and turned to his shadowy familiar.
"Mr. Asano,"
Shade said, his composure restored.
"If I ask you to do something, will you do it?"
"Anything,"
Jason said. Shade's uncharacteristic outburst had so startled him that it had shaken him from his rage.
"Then I will ask you not to do what you were about to do. Ever. Because,
why, doesn't matter,"
Jason cut in, his voice soft.
"If you want it, that's all the why I need."
"It matters, Mr. Asano. I know that you worry about what the actions you take are turning you into. You always wonder where the line is, and fear that you crossed it long ago without ever seeing it. You did not. This is the line, Mr. Asano. If you do this, there is no coming back. Not all the way."
Jason turned his head, looking from Shade to the cultist on the ground from Jason's soul attack. He was having a seizure, foaming at the mouth. The other cultists were showing expressions Jason had never witnessed from the various zealots he had encountered. He'd seen defiance and disdain, fury, madness, and the slack-jawed blankness of a puppet. Even under excruciating pain, inescapable capture, or certain death, their twisted faith sustained them. Fear was new. Even catching a glimpse of what Jason was doing to their fellow made them realize that death was not an escape. That whatever they worshipped, it either would not or could not shield them from a form of harm that would reach beyond the grave. It chilled them to a depth only the star seeds within them had ever reached before.
"Shade,"
Jason said wearily as he watched the cultists who would not meet his gaze.
"Yes, Mr. Asano."
"If you hadn't stopped me, I'd have torn that man's soul out. I imagine using his starseed would have let me actually damage it too."
"Yes, Mr. Asano. But you didn't."
"Only because you intervened.
I didn't even stop to think about it. Maybe I already have crossed that line."
He tapped a finger to his temple.
"In here. There is still a path home for you, Mr. Asano."
And where is home, Shade? I don't think I know anymore.
It's the same place it's always been, Mr. Asano. The place where people are waiting for you.
In the jungle cave, holding the aperture to the astral space, the rainbow portal stopped flickering as the seal on the other side was broken. Figures started emerging from it. First the collared cultists, then Jason. The cultists tried to self-detonate again, as Jason couldn't keep suppressing their star seeds while passing through the portal. He emerged and immediately shut them down, however, before they could kill themselves. Jason's ability to affect the star seeds had improved since his time in Greenstone, yet it was still harder to do so. He suspected that the Builder had altered the nature of the power he sent his minions, making it harder for Jason to affect them. Back in Greenstone, when he suppressed a starseed, it had stuck for some time. Now his control slipped the moment he wasn't actively maintaining it. Following Jason from the portal was Colin, still in blood clone form. He had the last cultist slung over his shoulder, still unconscious. Colin's bloody straps shot out to wrap around the other cultists, and he walked them behind Jason like they were dogs on a leash. Jason had sensed the presence of the adventurer expedition the moment he emerged from the astral space. They were arrayed in front of the Builder's vessels, who had broken down considerably in the short time he'd been gone. Jason arrived as the vessels were using their cold, mechanical harmony to address the wary expedition members.
"Have a proposal for you."
"Not interested," the expedition leader, Jenny Cavaloa, told the vessels.
"If Jason Asano dies," the Builder continued, "my forces shall abandon the Storm Kingdom, never to return. The underwater city will depart. Everyone and everything that serves me will either leave or destroy itself outright. All it will cost you is one silver rank head. It must be the silver rankers amongst you who take it, however. The gold ranker cannot intervene herself."
Jason wasn't surprised by the Builder's brazenness. The great astral being knew he was watching, yet was attempting to solicit his murder right in front of him. It made Jason wonder how many times he had been thrown under the bus by someone in power that was ostensibly an ally. Lucian Lamprey of the Magic Society, Elspeth Arella of the Adventure Society, the Network more than anyone. They had turned on him over and over, with the gall to ask for things in between, passing the blame on to rogue elements and hostile factions. Jason didn't think he could be surprised anymore, only to be proven immediately wrong.
"Stick it up your ass," the guild team leader Corinne yelled. "Asano might be an overbearing asshole that takes himself way too seriously, but he's our asshole, and we don't turn on our own assholes."
Even with the Builder's vessels arrayed right in front of them, the expedition members all turned to look at her.
"Shut up," she barked defensively. "I'm not good at speeches, all right?"
The Builder ignored her.
"What say you, gold ranker?"
the vessels asked.
"You are the foremost representative of the Adventure Society here and command these silver rankers. You do not even need to spill the blood on your own hands. How many lives can be spared in return for one silver rank head? Are you willing to pay the blood price of war when I offer you peace?"
"We're not handing anyone over to you," Jenny said.
"And what of you, princesses? The monster surge will be long, and when it is gone, and I with it, a new storm will come. Will your kingdom be rested and ready to weather it, or battered and tired when the time comes to face it?"
Vesper stepped forward, panning her gaze across the row of crumbling vessels.
"If having Asano dead is worth more to you than our entire kingdom," she declared, "then the most important thing our kingdom can do is make sure he stays alive."
"That may be harder than you think," the vessels announced.
You may know that Asano has come back from the dead more than once. What he has hidden is that he cannot do it anymore. Until he reaches gold rank, no power in the cosmos can revive him again.
Taking the last word, the vessels died. The power inside them was withdrawn by the builder, and they collapsed to the ground. Jason left the cave with an unfamiliar sense of gratitude to the members of the expedition. He walked through the still-fighting constructs and abominations, those he controlled pushing those he didn't out of his path to open the way. The adventurers watched Jason and his entourage of bound cultists pass through the still-fighting builder minions. Jason looked at the dead vessels as he walked past them. Because they hadn't been properly prepared as vessels, they had collapsed entirely into piles of dried dirt. At least it meant they were too broken to revive as magic-sucking ghouls the way sturdier vessels had in the past. Jenny looked at Asano, whose aura was now a closed book to her. She hoped that it was because he had gotten a handle of the madness that had been bubbling out of him, and not just that he'd gotten better at hiding it. Whatever he had been up to, the look of restrained anger on his face since she had met him had been replaced with a sunken weariness.
Mr. Asano, you and I need to have a discussion.
Jason nodded.
I don't make a very good subordinate, he acknowledged. It's not a new failing of mine.
When you chose to join this expedition, there was an expectation that you would follow directions.
Jason looked from Jenny to Vespa and then back to Jenny.
I apologize for that. In my defense, I was following directions, just not yours. I was given some earlier.
Jenny took her turn looking to Vespa, then back to Jason.
Politics,
she said, making a dirty word of it.
Tell me about it,
Jason sympathized, turning to look at the princesses. Silent and brooding was what you said, wasn't it, Vespa? Oh, and Zara, if you're still looking to get married, we'll have to talk about that later. He turned back to Jenny.
I shut down the sealing ritual on the other side of the aperture, he told her. But there's still plenty of bad guys in there, and we should get going before they repair it and seal the aperture again.
Jason turned and wandered back in the direction of the cave.
Okay, Corinne said. Who was that guy? And what happened to the other guy?
Same guy,
Vespa said happily as she set off after Jason.
He just put the mask back on.
Chapter 51. I don't think you're angry.
I still say we should have fished whatever that thing was out of that fire lake,
one of the guild team members said.
We weren't there to kill monsters, said Corinne, the team leader. We were there to stop the Builder cult from prying the astral space off the side of our world and blasting this whole region apart in the process.
The expedition had just emerged from the astral space, and the expedition leader, Jenny, was setting up a device that would seal the astral space aperture. She had roped Jason, who was an astral magic specialist, into helping.
If the Builder sends more people, this will only slow them down, not stop them, Jason warned her.
We can't permanently assign a protective detail with everything else going on, Jenny explained. We don't have the people. There are scout patrols that check on the astral space apertures, but this is the first line of defense. As long as it slows them down and sends out a warning signal if anyone interferes with it, that's as much as we can ask for.
Jason was connecting the seal to a device provided by Jenny called an aura beacon. It would use a powerful, directed burst of artificial aura as a signal when triggered, like a magical flare. They finished up and the expedition prepared to move out. The prisoners had been implanted with rune-covered spiked rods, buried in the flesh of their arms, legs, and torso. The rods had a similar suppressive effect on starseeds as Jason's abilities, preventing self-detonation.
They gave me the rods, but we weren't anticipating prisoners, Jenny said, looking at them. Normally it's hard to catch them before they self-detonate, so you only get prisoners when you plan the operation around their capture.
Four of the five prisoners sat on the ground in a cluster, fearful eyes avoiding Jason. The last was still unconscious from what Jason had done to him.
Want me to transport them? Jason asked. If you have something that will work, Jenny said. Shade, what have you got? Darkness spilled out of Jason's shadow and took the form of a giant black beetle the size of a bread van. Along its sides were thin vertical gaps in the chitinous exterior, revealing the insect's interior to be mostly hollow. The hard interior shell made for a secure space with room for half a dozen people at a squeeze. The top and bottom halves of almost the entire carapace opened up like a set of enormous jaws, making a gap through which the prisoners could be shoved.
Tartarian beetle, Jenny said, moving around the beetle as she looked it over. They capture prey and carry it around with them, keeping it alive for days before eating it. Never seen a black one before.
That does not look comfortable, Jason said. Will it do?
I can live with not comfortable. Is it going to eat them?
I don't know, Shade. Are you going to eat them?
Mr. Asano, I shall refrain from dignifying that with a response.
Jason and Jenny loaded the prisoners into the maw of the beetle, which was not unlike pushing them into the back of a divvy van. Jason reflected that it was a mundane feeling for such a bizarre experience as shoving a bunch of people into a giant insect. While they were doing that, the rest of the group continued to talk amongst themselves, with the self-confident guild team the loudest.
It wasn't much of a force, Team Scout Rosa said. They didn't even have a gold ranker.
This is a minor astral space, which is why it's in a cave in the middle of the jungle, said the team leader, Corinne. If there was anything worth harvesting out of it, there'd be a village here, and we wouldn't have to make our own road. If it wouldn't be so destructive, they'd probably let the builder have the damn thing. It's probably not worth much more to him than to us.
You think that was really the builder talking to those creepy people?
Rosa asked. I don't see why not, Corinne told her. Gods show up in worship squares every day, and he's some kind of weird god, right?
No way that was the real thing. Probably some local cult leader using a weird power to speak to his troops. He just claimed to be the builder to impress us. That deal he offered was a steaming pyre.
I don't know, you felt that aura, right? That was divine.
It wasn't divine, Oren said, which drew the group's attention. As with most people who spoke rarely, people listened when he did. They were silver and bronze rank auras, Oren continued. The power didn't change, they just had something inside them that made them feel like that. Asano has it too, but nowhere near as much.
You get a good look at Asano's aura?
Corinne asked. The others had only sensed Jason's aura unleashed in the midst of battle when there had been many other auras overlapping. He also hadn't pushed it out with the oppressive strength he was capable of, blending it in so that he could leave the fight unnoticed.
He showed it to me once, so I'd know not to make trouble, Oren said.
You think that's how he makes those things fight each other? He's got some builder in him.
It wasn't builder in him, Oren said. Not alien like those people. It was gods. I've seen it before. When gods touch your soul, they leave a mark.
The group all looked to Asano, shoving people into a giant insect.
Who is that guy?
Corinne said, voicing the question they were all thinking. The two princesses, meanwhile, were talking within a privacy screen as they stood side by side. Zara's eyes were on Jason while Vespa was watching the guild team.
This couldn't have gone better, Vespa said, rubbing her hands together. The builder showing up in person, more or less. I'm not clear on how Asano got those things fighting one another or got into that astral space, but it plays right into the mysterious stranger narrative. Plus that new dark side to him. Yes, please.
I don't think this is as good an outcome as you seem to think, Zara told her.
It really is. This expedition has gone beyond my most optimistic expectations. We need to top it off by having people see the two of you talking together. Just make sure people see you and that you use a privacy screen. Keep it mysterious. We want people wondering. Aunt Vespa, it's clear that he's not in a good place right now.
It's good for me.
Aunt Vespa, Zara admonished. Just look at the way the expedition is grouped. The guild members over there, us here, unaffiliated, off to the side. Asano should be with them, but he's not. He's with the gold ranker, talking like an equal. Even if people don't think about it, they notice it. It places him within a hierarchy of importance in their minds, without them even realizing. I think Asano might be volatile. Volatile is working out nicely. Aunt Vespa,
fine. It's not like I was serious about having him murdered.
About having him what?
Look, if you want to listen to him talk about his feelings or whatever, that's your business. Just do it behind a privacy screen the way I said. Remember why we're here.
I know why I'm here, Zara said. I'm still not sure why you are. I needed to keep an eye on things. Liara said it was because Trenchant Maud teased you. Liara has a big mouth.
As the group pulled out their various means of transport, Jason looked at the pathway the expedition had cleared through the jungle. It was a trail of destruction leading off into the distance.
I assume that was you? He said to Jenny.
One of my expedition subordinates went off against orders to provoke the enemy, so I didn't want to tarry.
Jason winced. Sorry about that. I'm kind of working through some stuff.
Save that for people aren't relying on you to watch their backs. You'll forgive me if I try to avoid working with you again. Whether it's grim murder mode or whatever cheerful front you're putting up now, you're neither honest nor stable.
That seems a little harsh.
Harsh? Do you think killing a lot of enemies by yourself gets you anything? I could let the guild team loose like a dog in a butcher shop, and they'd tear through anything you found here. All you mean to me are questions you won't answer, orders you won't follow, and running off alone to mess up the group's plans. Do you think my assessment of your performance on this contract will be anything but scathing? I was specifically asked to assess you for potential promotion to 2 stars, but I'll be arguing against it in the strongest possible terms.
Jason nodded. That's fair. Star rating is based on judgment, and even I don't trust mine right now. Jenny gave him a concerned look.
I don't know what you have going on, Asano, but go to the Church of the Healer. Get some help.
An ice cloud appeared at Jenny's feet, and she headed off. Jason took another long look at the path of destruction, which was quite thorough. I reckon a regular skimmer could manage that. What do you think, Shade?
I could manage a small airship, rather than the group needing to rendezvous with one.
I think we've shown quite enough of the rabbits in our hat for one day, Jason said. Let's stick with a skimmer. Shade took the form of a skimmer, parked next to the giant beetle, while Jason walked over to the princesses. The rest of the expedition pretended they weren't watching. Vespa was on her sapphire heidel, while Zara stood on what looked like a miniature hurricane. Give you a ride, princess? Jason asked Zara. It's past time you and I had a little talk.
She'd love to, Vespa said, setting off on her construct creature steed.
The small storm at Zara's feet dissipated, and she followed Jason to the skimmer. It was a heavy skimmer with comfortable seating for 4, much like he had used for most of his delivery contract. He opened the side door and got in the back, Zara doing the same to sit next to him. Jason pulled the privacy screen pin from his inventory and pinned it to his chest before tapping it to activate. The expedition was taking off, following Jenny. The skimmer moved forward smoothly on its own as Jason and Zara sat in silence, unsure of what to say.
When you came stumbling into my tent those years ago, Zara said, finally, I never imagined we'd end up here.
Jason turned to look at her. Even at iron rank, she'd been as stunningly beautiful as anyone he'd ever seen. It had driven him to flirt with her at the time, but that inclination was long dead. I was going to haul off on you, he said. I was going to tell you all about why I'm running around so angry.
I don't think you're angry, Mr. Asano. I don't see rage when I look at you. I see a tiredness that will take more than rest to recover from.
Jason looked away from the princess. You're very different, he said wearily.
You too. I am sorry for getting you involved in my mess.
There's no changing it now. All we can do is move forward.
You must hate me.
I don't hate you, princess. I understand knowing that you'll have to shake the tree if you want anything to fall out. I've made those choices,
been willing to pay the price, only to realize that other people are stuck paying for me. Zara nodded. Learn faster than I did, Princess. Shade, stop the skimmer. The skimmer slowed to a halt. You have something that you need to do, Jason said, then tapped his pin to drop the privacy shield. She got out of the skimmer and turned to look at him.
This isn't 3 years ago, Asano, she said coldly. And this isn't some provincial backwater on the far side of the globe. I have responsibilities as a member of the Rimuros family, and I won't let you get in the way of that.
Her travel cloud appeared at her feet, and she took off after the still-moving expedition. Let's get going, Shade. Chapter 52 Staying with Friends. Autumn Leal was tired. In the course of what she had thought was an ordinary delivery run, she had been ambushed by a team of purity loyalists. Outnumbered and outmatched, she had thought she was done for, until the guild team she hadn't known were trailing her in stealth appeared. They captured and took away the loyalists that survived the resulting ambush, leaving Autumn to complete her supply contract. She didn't like being bait, but she did like coming home alive, so she called the whole thing even, completed her deliveries, and returned to the airship for the trip back. The airship was diverted slightly to pick up an expedition of adventurers operating in the wilderness, who proved to be an unusual bunch. There was a guild team, some unaffiliated adventurers and prisoners, who turned out to be some of the builder cultists people had been talking about for so long. The magic rods sticking out of their flesh seemed to be triggering strange aura reaction, making them seem alien and bizarre. More unusual still, at least to her, was the member of the group she recognized. The final trio of the expedition's membership was made up of Jason Asano, along with two women with the iconic blue hair of the Rimuros family. They were talking inside a privacy screen when Jason spotted her and left the screen to approach her across the deck. "G'day," he said to her, his words accompanied by a smile that looked as weary as she felt. "Another delivery contract?" "Yes," she said, warily, nodding in the direction of the blue-haired women.
"Are they?"
"Yeah." The skyship Jason was riding in was an unusual design. It looked like an ordinary ship suspended from three hot air balloons by huge brass chains, except that the balloons were massive, pale blue crystals. Looking for some solitude, Jason slipped over the side and under the ship, conjuring his cloak to keep him aloft. A shadow arm emerged from his back to grip the keel of the ship, forming a tether that pulled Jason along as he watched the landscape pass below. "Look at this," he said, happily. "This is how it's meant to be. Magic and wonders." Shade emerged from Jason's shadowy cloak to float alongside Jason.
"Loath as I am to interrupt your moment of peace, Mr. Asano, Miss Hurden has requested to speak with you. Again. She is becoming increasingly concerned at my repeated refusals. I normally wouldn't bring it up, but it is Miss Hurden."
"Quite right," Jason said. As much as he was enjoying drifting through the air, he owed Farah too much to leave her hanging any longer. He'd already brushed her off too many times during his recent emo rampage. He closed his eyes, felt for the connection to Shade, and expanded his senses. He saw through the body Shade had left in the cloud house, where Farah was pacing back and forth in agitation. "I'm fine," Jason said through the familiar.
"Fine nothing," she said, wheeling on Shade. "I'd reach through Shade and choke you if I could. What were you thinking, running off in that frame of mind?"
"It wasn't the best choice," Jason acknowledged. "At least that's on brand for me."
"You think cracking jokes will make me forget that you're one self-impressed aristocrat away from murdering someone that will get you in real trouble?"
"It's all right, Farah. Shade pulled me back from the precipice."
"The precipice of what?"
"Maybe we can talk about this when I'm not hanging from the underside of a skyship."
"Why are you doing that?"
"Why isn't everyone? It's awesome.
I needed something fun, Farah, something simple and joyous. It's easy to forget that's a thing, you know?"
In the cloud house,
Farah dropped into a chair as if the rage fueling her had just run out.
Jason, I don't like you being out there alone, not when you're running the ragged edge.
I'm not alone. And these Rimuros people aren't too bad, as it turns out. I mean, the royal family dragging me into their mess was a dick move, but they did think I wasn't around to get hurt. They might have their own agendas, but they seem pretty decent. It's a little sad that I was surprised they aren't trying to screw me over.
Are you at least on the way back?
Yeah, but I'm not going to Portal. Farah nodded.
You don't break up the expedition until the contract is done, she said. During the monster surge, that means when everyone is home safe.
The airship descended through the skies of Rimuros. As it headed for the sky dock towers on the island of Liveros, they entered a rapidly increasing level of air traffic. One vehicle stood out, both for its design and the fact that it was heading for the Royal Sky Island and not Liveros.
Is that a flying cottage?
Zara asked. A rustic garden cottage, complete with garden, flew through the air within a shimmering orb. Jason took his eyes from the orb to peer at Vespa's feet. Vespa noticed his gaze.
What are you looking at?
She asked. I was just wondering if you had ruby slippers. Are you from the East?
What are you talking about?
Do you?
No. And no.
Jason pointed up at the cottage. You should be careful it doesn't fall on you anyway. I've seen that happen before.
You've seen that vessel before?
Zara asked. Not in person, but there's a famous story about something similar where I come from. If I recall correctly, isn't the main road connecting the towns of Arnot made of yellow bricks?
What in the world are you talking about?
Vespa asked. Soromir and Liara were waiting on a landing platform on top of the royal palace. Trenchant Moor stood silently behind them.
Do not speak unless addressed directly,
Soromir instructed Liara.
She's not known for being tolerant of mortals. When I bow, you don't.
Why not?
Because you're a Rimuros. Never bow unless you know exactly why you're doing it. You can bow, Commander Moore.
As you will it, Ancestral Majesty.
Soromir's behavior gave Liara far more effective warning than his words. For her entire life, he had been a legend, an unseen figure representing the pinnacle of power and authority. He had been far more approachable in his sensibilities than she had expected upon finally meeting him, but still radiated power that placed him second in her mind only to the gods. To see him almost nervous was an unsettling revelation. The cottage orb paused at the invisible magic barrier, where even the most prestigious visitors went through rigorous checks. The diamond rank Zila Rimuros oversaw the checks, going into the cottage for a time before emerging and flying off. The vehicle moved through the magical barrier and floated down to settle on the platform. The orb vanished to leave a cottage garden incongruously sitting on the roof of the royal palace. The door opened, and a woman emerged. She was a Celestine with ruby hair and alabaster skin. It was a fiery contrast to the cool sapphire blue of the three Rimuros royals. She wore a white summer dress with embellishments of yellow and orange. The dress swayed gently as she made her way down the path to stand before the trio, greeting them with a slight nod. Soromir responded with a bow as Trenchant Moor behind him echoed the gesture.
First sister, we are honored by your visit,
Soromir said in greeting.
I have passed the position of first sister along,
Dawn said.
My apologies, Hierophant. I see that you are not unschooled in the disposition of the wider cosmos.
Yes, Hierophant. I have spent some time traveling beyond my world, only returning in these times of trouble. I must thank you for accepting my request and visiting us. I am in your debt, both for bringing your knowledge and grace to our kingdom and for accepting my request to bring certain people with you.
Actually, Lord Rimuros, there was a problem with your request.
Liara felt Soromir go tense next to her.
Problem, Hierophant?
A slight smile teased the corner of Dawn's lips. The list of names you wished me to bring along was incomplete. A failure of communication, perhaps. I took it upon myself to add the appropriate names and bring them with me.
Saramir relaxed.
Thank you for correcting my oversight, Hierophant. I am in your debt over again. We have prepared accommodations for you, or will you perhaps be staying with friends?
Your accommodations will no doubt be sufficient to my needs, Dawn said.
Then please, come with me. My descendant, Liara, and the highly capable Commander Moore will see to the disposition of the people you have brought with you.
Dawn turned to look at the cottage, and 11 people emerged, looking around. A half dozen were silver rank, along with 4 bronze rankers and 1 gold. Most were human, but there was a Leonid, an elf, and a Celestine amongst them. 2 of the outworlders were bronze rank. One had clearly been a human originally, and while the other one was, as well, in poor lighting, he could be confused for a Leonid or even a lifelike golem. She had never seen a human standing next to a Leonid without being dwarfed before. The final 2 bronze rankers were human and older than the others. Essences had enhanced their youthfulness, but there were telltale signs of having gained magic later in life that would not be erased until silver rank. Soromir's attention was drawn to the sword the Leonid carried loosely by the scabbard. In his hand, and not